Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. Dr. Zeit by Antonia Fraser. I'm being pursued by this face, she thought. This old face. I'm frightened. I'll have to do something. The first time Nola saw the face, she was in the underground, on the moving stairs coming up to the Tottingham Court Road, the last leg of the journey. Nola always felt like a seal coming up for air at Tottenham Court Road tube with its double staircase. She began to breathe deeply as she reached the top. Nola was not particularly strong, and she felt she needed all the air she could get before she reached the British Museum and the somewhat airless atmosphere of its reading room. Nola had been working for the past 2 years on a study of 17th-century family life. She still had a long way to go. From time to time, she told her publisher, lightly, that 20th-century family life came first, which meant the house in Islington with the lovely wooden polished floors, kitchen often full of healthy foods, large country-style garden, all of them rivals for her attention with the British Museum. And, of course, there were Dennis and Johnny. Dennis was Nola's husband, and Johnny was her son. To Nola, privately, they were the perfect family unit. She had no wish for another child. Dennis protected Nola. He was much older than her. And Nola protected Johnny. Indeed, when she thought about Johnny's small but perfectly male body, Nola imagined that she felt the same joy that Dennis often told her he felt in her youth, her beauty, because of the difference in their ages, he said. To him, she would always look young, no matter how the years passed. On her route to and from the British Museum, Nola's favorite thoughts were of the two of them. She was meditating on Johnny and how perfect he was, and how, in a way, she wished he could stay 5 years old forever. So gay, so ebullient, so amusing, so much her little boy, when she felt a slight tug on her long skirt. Nola turned round. The staircase was not particularly crowded. It was after 10 o'clock, and the workers had vanished to their offices. Several steps below her, a woman with a very old face was smiling at her. At least Nola thought at the time that she was a woman, but she was so very old, judging from her face at least, that she had already reached that stage of asexuality of appearance which makes it difficult to tell the inhabitants of male and female geriatric wards apart. Nola had certainly never seen the woman before in her life. Nola presumed, therefore, that she had dropped something, but her bag was standing neatly intact on the step above her. She checked it, looked round again, missed the old woman completely, found the top of the staircase claiming her attention, searched for her ticket, and forgot the incident. The second time that Nola saw the face, it was definitely on a man. On him. That was how she instinctively put it to herself, because despite the fact that the face was exactly the same as the previous face, old, really old, seemingly wrinkled flesh hanging round the jowls, wispy hair, she got the odd impression that she was not seeing the same person so much as the same face. On this occasion, she saw the face and its bearer standing on the platform of Tottingham Court Road tube station as her train drew in. She had a quick, uncomfortable flash of recognition, and the face, the man, rather, seemed to feel likewise because he gave a little salute with his hand. The other hand held a stick. When Nola got off the train, he was gone. He had presumably entered the train elsewhere, where it was less crowded. The third occasion she saw the face was more disturbing. It was Johnny's half-term. Nola had a choice of staying at home with him or taking him along with her, since Dennis was, of course, at the office. She decided to take him on a visit to the British Museum. Not into the reading room, of course. That was out of the question. Perish the thought of introducing rambunctious Johnny into such a sanctum, even if it had been permitted. But she did think it would be rather pleasant to show Johnny some of the sights— the Elgin marbles, vast sphinxes, statues, the sort of thing that an intelligent 5-year-old would find quite stimulating to the imagination without precisely understanding them. And she would point to the door of the reading room, perhaps, and call it Mum's office. Johnny knew about offices. He had visited Dennis's office on several occasions. When Dennis returned in the evening, Johnny used to chant, "Back from the office," as if it was all one word. They set off early so as to be back for Johnny's lunch. But Johnny and Nola never got as far as the British Museum. At Tottenham Court Road Station, this is where Mum comes to work in the morning, the most awful thing happened. Johnny disappeared. One moment he was holding Nola's hand, the next moment there was a sharp tug and he was gone. Through the pressing crowd he vanished completely. Nola was distraught, sick with fear. "Johnny! Johnny!" she screamed, turning round and trying to battle her way against the incoming crowd. She struggled back finally onto the platform from whence they had come, and saw two things. Johnny, tearful, holding the hand of a black underground inspector who was bending down and trying to comfort him. For a split second she also saw that face, that old face. She would know it anywhere. But this time, on quite a young and sturdy body, she had the impression of jeans, a t-shirt. The man, woman, whatever it was, smiled and vanished down the far exit to the other line. Johnny, sobbing, seemed to expect Nola to punish him. In self-defense, he talked of a horrible old man with a nasty smell pulling him away. "I couldn't help it. He was much stronger than me," he kept saying. "Darling, we're going straight home," was all Nola could bring herself to reply. When she told Dennis about it in the evening, an edited version not mentioning the previous encounters with the face, he said quite sharply, "Wasn't it rather silly to take a kid to the BM in the first place? I mean, you can go there as much as you like when he's at school. I shouldn't think it would have been quite his cup of tea if he had got there. He's still at the playground stage, if you ask me." Nola, feeling guilty, forbore to mention her plan of showing the door of Mum's office. Dennis was right. Johnny had not yet reached the sightseeing stage. She was the one who did not want him to grow up too fast, and now she was trying to force the pace. The fourth, fifth, and sixth times Nola saw the face were in and around Islington when she's shopping or on her way to fetch Johnny from school. On each occasion, the face smiled at her. Johnny was right. It was definitely an old man. The impression of a youthful body in jeans that day must have been part of her general distraction at losing the child. The truth was, she told herself, that he was just a rather mad old man who happened to live in Islington and filled in the time leering at young women. Perfectly harmless, if unpleasant. Nola pulled herself up. Not totally harmless, if her theory was correct. The old man had tried to kidnap Johnny. No, that was really going much too far in the other direction. Kidnap was far too strong a word. Dennis had been right when he pointed out that Johnny was only a child, had been known to wriggle his hand free under other circumstances. "Probably just didn't want to go to the BM," said Dennis, with a smile. He worried a little all the time, not about Johnny, but about Nola. Nola, of all the women he knew, was the most conscientious mother and wife, and then there was her book and her health. Health, which was never strong and could easily lead to nervousness and collapse if Nola overstretched herself. However, Dennis and Nola had agreed long ago when they first married never to refer to Nola's condition and to live their lives exactly as if it did not exist. So Dennis decided to say nothing more on this occasion, only to watch Nola more carefully in future. At least he could try and see that she did not overdo the British Museum stuff. But of course, Nola's projected book had to have its place in her life along with the house and the garden and the creative kitchen and Dennis and Johnny. The idea had originated as a postgraduate thesis suggested by Nola's tutor, who had a high opinion of her work. It was a task to which marriage to Dennis and the birth of Johnny put an end. Only temporarily, however. Nola got back to it once Johnny went to nursery school, and it was really much more fun doing it in terms of a proper book, being her own mistress, as it were, without the inevitable restraints of the structure of a thesis. Besides which, she no longer needed a grant to support herself while working on it. "You're my grant," she told Dennis, "and a very nice grant, too." If Nola's progress was slow, school holidays were an interruption, at least it was steady, and she never found any difficulty in picking up her work again when she left off. The mere entry into the atmosphere of the reading room, airless as it might be, transported her. It was in its own way like a secret garden to which Nola, and admittedly 500 others, had the key. So it was fantastically upsetting one morning, as she arrived later than her schedule, to see the face, sitting three along from the seat she usually occupied. Not in her seat, thank God. That would have been too much. Might have persuaded her she was seeing an apparition, A sort of doppelganger, an aged version of herself, but she wasn't seeing an apparition, she knew that. This old woman, and she was definitely a woman this time, was real. What was more, as Nola flung down her bag on her seat, the woman with the old face got up and shuffled off in the direction of the North Library. The old face did not smile, Nola noticed. There was a nasty, set, grumpy look about it, the mouth above the hanging dewlaps. On the whole, however, Nola preferred this air of crossness, even anger, to the original leer. Besides which, the old woman had left her books behind on the table. Nola could see them lying there. Now was her chance to find out a little more about her pursuer. With a feeling of determination, Nola strode down the row of desks and picked up the book lying open. She nearly dropped it with surprise. It was Levin Shucking's Puritan Family. It was a comparatively new book which had come out since Nola began working on her subject, and Nola had made quite a bit of use of it herself. She did not know why she was so surprised at the sight of it on the old woman's desk. It was a most disagreeable sensation. Still more disagreeable was the discovery that the other four books on the desk were all pertaining to the subject of women and marriage in the 17th century, or, as you might put it, 17th century family life. Some of them were quite obscure. Nola took a decision. She put in a slip for Shucking's book and duly got her slip returned with the scribbled information on the back that it was out to another reader. She could not quite read it, but the name looked like Zet. Nola went to the center desk and explained her problem. The old lady who has it out was sitting quite close to me, as a matter of fact, but she went out an hour ago and hasn't returned, so I wondered if I could just check something. Name? Said the man behind the desk with professional politeness, but without interest. Zet, it looks like, or Zelt. The man's face clouded. Oh, dear, old Mrs. Zeit, or rather Frau Dr. Zeit, as she prefers to be called. Oh, dear. Well, I'll see what I can do when she comes back. Is she, Nola pursued delicately, prompting, not finishing the sentence. The man grinned and raised his eyebrows. She saw that he was quite young. Shall we say that she's a little difficult, he said. We get them in here, delusions of persecution, probably a refugee from somewhere. She thinks everyone is trying to steal her researches from her before she can write her book. And her book is on? The young man took thought. 17th century family life, he answered. Something like that. He was surprised when Nola, who had seemed such a pleasant person, turned on her heel abruptly and marched out of the reading room. Actually, Nola was going to the ladies because she felt dizzy, and when she came back she just collected her bag and left. Frau Dr. Zeit was not there. All the same, she knew she could not do any work that day. This was the point at which Nola thought, I'm being pursued by this face, this old face. I'm frightened. I shall have to do something. She told Dennis that she had discovered an old woman in the reading room who was working on exactly the same subject as herself, and for a book, too. She felt that it was a catastrophe. That was as far as Nola could bring herself to relate recent events for the time being. If Dennis were sympathetic, and she knew he would be, she could probably nerve herself to discuss the face itself thereafter. "Don't go to the British Museum, darling, for a bit," said Dennis immediately. "You've had a shock, I can see that. Not that some old crone is really going to write a book and steal your thunder. Not a chance. Your book will be terrific when it comes out, never fear. But the truth is you've been overdoing it lately. A rest here at home will freshen you up. Work twice as hard when you get back to it." "I've got so much to get through," Nola began rather desperately. Dennis soothed her. "Darling, I know. But the time's passing. There's plenty of time. For one thing, Johnny won't be a baby forever. He won't need fetching and carrying from school forever." "And I suppose you're going to grow out of needing a hot dinner at night," said Nola wryly. "Exactly," Dennis beamed. "My teeth will soon fall out. Then I shan't be able to eat anything but cereal. That means you won't have to cook at all." Nola looked worried again. "Don't talk like that," she begged. "On top of everything else, you know I can't bear to think of you getting old." It was a solitary hang-up she had about the disparity in their ages. She could not bear a mention of such things, even a light reflection like the fact that Dennis would be 65 and retiring when Johnny was 21 and going out to work, caused her to shiver. "Now, Nola," said Dennis, taking her in his arms, "you really are out to upset yourself, aren't you? As for me, I'm in the pink of health. I had the firm's annual medical checkup today. I forgot to tell you with all this going on. I'm A1 okay, the doctor told me, the physique of a young man. Not so the doctor himself, I must say. Talking of the old, this was the oldest fellow I've ever seen. I thought I must have made a mistake when I stepped into the consulting room. He looked just like a tortoise. A man with a very old face? Nola asked carefully after a pause. That's right. He might have been Methuselah himself, but he gave me a clean bill of health. Wait a moment, darling. I'm crazy. You know him. When I said goodbye, he asked me to give you his love. You and Johnny, but especially you. He's an Austrian. Dr. Zeit, I think his name was. Why, darling. As Dennis held Nola, he felt her go slack and heavy in his arms. She had fainted. It was nothing, said Nola a minute later when she found herself sitting on the sofa. Just one of my turns. Don't fuss me. You promised. She saw Dennis's anxious face leaning over her and went on. Don't worry. It was like when they were first married. Her one concern was to reassure him about her. But Dennis did worry. Despite Nola's protests, he insisted on putting her to bed for the rest of the evening. In return, he promised not to fuss her too much the next day. Nevertheless, Nola did not even try to go to the British Museum. She did not feel up to it, and she kept Johnny at home, too, although Dennis did not know that until later. He generally left for the office before Johnny went to school. All the same, Nola was determined not to waste the day entirely. She pondered between the rival claims of kitchen and garden. A day cooking for the deep freeze, or a day really tidying up the garden before the onset of winter. In the end, the garden won, because Nola had to admit that the garden was showing signs of positive neglect, whereas the kitchen wasn't. When Dennis telephoned her later that morning, ostensibly to consult her about an invitation, Nola told him, "By the way, I'm clearing up the garden. It's rather fun." "Just the ticket," Dennis managed to sound delighted. "It's a beautiful day for it, too. I walked half the way to the office." Nola dug a little, created a pile of rubbish, and finally went indoors with the laudable intention of doing to the airing cupboard what she had done for the garden. She was upstairs on a ladder, reaching for the back of the cupboard when she heard the front door bell ring. Nola hesitated and looked at Johnny. "Johnny, could you?" "Course I could," he said contemptuously. Later, Johnny shouted something up the stairs about the garden. Nola was rather puzzled. She ought really to go down, but Johnny had panted back up the stairs again. "Daddy sent someone to do the garden for you, so I let him through the back door," he said importantly. "Oh, I see." Nola was taken aback and suddenly rather chilled. Hadn't she been going to do the garden herself? Dennis was treating her like a baby again, not wanting her to strain herself. Presently Nola looked out of the window and saw the gardener's back. He was wearing jeans, and to her surprise he appeared to be wielding a scythe. She looked again. Yes, it was definitely a scythe. In their garden at this time of year? What was Dennis thinking of? Johnny was in his room, playing with his little cars in the window seat. Nola gave him a quick glance and then clattered down the stairs and into the garden. "Excuse me," she said in a voice of authority. "What are you doing with that scythe?" The young man stood up and turned round. He was still holding his scythe as he moved towards Nola. His voice was quite young and musical when he replied, "I'm caring for your garden. Don't worry, I shall be here to care for it after you're gone." But his face was an old face, a familiar face. Johnny, looking out of the window, saw his mother fall down and lie still. Later he described to his father exactly the man who had come to do the garden, the man with the scythe and jeans, but a man with a terribly old face. He told his father that the man with the terribly old face had cut down his mother with his scythe. But that was nonsense, of course, a child's reaction to shock. There was not a mark on Nola's body. And that story was Dr. Zeit by Antonia Fraser from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The second story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. Two Bluebirds by D.H. Lawrence. There was a woman who loved her husband, but she could not live with him. The husband, on his side, was sincerely attached to his wife, yet he could not live with her. They were both under 40, both handsome, and both attractive. They had the most sincere regard for one another and felt, in some odd way, eternally married to one another. They knew one another more intimately than they knew anybody else. They felt more known to one another than to any other person. Yet they could not live together. Usually they kept 1,000 miles apart geographically. But when he sat in the greyness of England, at the back of his mind, with a certain grim fidelity, he was aware of his wife, her strange yearning to be loyal and faithful, having her gallant affairs away in the sun, in the south. And she, as she drank her cocktail on the terrace over the sea, and turned her grey sardonic eyes on the heavy dark face of her admirer, whom she really liked quite a lot, she was actually preoccupied with the clear-cut features of her handsome young husband, thinking of how he would be asking his secretary to do something for him, asking in that good-natured, confident voice of a man who knows that his request will be only too gladly fulfilled. The secretary, of course, adored him. She was very competent, quite young, and quite good-looking. She adored him. But then all his servants always did, particularly his women servants. His men servants were likely to swindle him. When a man has an adoring secretary, and you are the man's wife, what are you to do? Not that there was anything wrong, if you know what I mean, between them. Nothing you could call adultery to come down to brass tacks. No, no. They were just the young master and his secretary. He dictated to her, she slaved for him and adored him, and the whole thing went on wheels. He didn't adore her. A man doesn't need to adore his secretary. But he depended on her. I simply rely on Miss Rexall. Whereas he could never rely on his wife. The one thing he knew finally about her was that she didn't intend to be relied on. So they remained friends, in the awful unspoken intimacy of the once married. Usually each year they went away together for a holiday, and if they had not been man and wife, they would have found a great deal of fun and stimulation in one another. The fact that they were married, had been married for the last 12 years, and couldn't live together for the last 3 or 4, spoilt them for one another. Each had a private feeling of bitterness about the other. However, they were awfully kind. He was a soul of generosity and held her in real, tender esteem, no matter how many gallant affairs she had. Her gallant affairs were part of her modern necessity. After all, I've got to live. I can't turn into a pillar of salt in 5 minutes just because you and I can't live together. It takes years for a woman like me to turn into a pillar of salt. At least I hope so. Quite, he replied, quite. By all means, put them in pickle. Make pickled cucumbers of them before you crystallize out. That's my advice. He was like that, so awfully clever and enigmatic. She could more or less fathom the idea of the pickled cucumbers, but the crystallizing out? What did that signify? And did he mean to suggest that he himself had been well pickled, and that further immersion was for him unnecessary, would spoil his flavor? Was that what he meant? And herself, was she the brine and the veil of tears? You never knew how catty a man was being when he was really clever and enigmatic, withal a bit whimsical. He was adorably whimsical, with a twist of his flexible, vain mouth that had a long upper lip so fraught with vanity. But then a handsome, clear-cut, histrionic young man like that, how could he help being vain? The other women made him so. Ah, the women! How nice men would be if there were no other women! And how nice the women would be if there were no other men! That's the best of a secretary. She may have a husband, but a husband is a mere shred of a man compared to a boss, a chief, a man who dictates to you and whose words you faithfully write down and then transcribe. Imagine a wife writing down anything her husband said to her. But a secretary! Every and but of his she preserves forever. What are candied violets in comparison? Now it is all very well having gallant affairs under the southern sun when you know there is a husband whom you adore dictating to a secretary whom you are too scornful to hate yet whom you rather despise, though you allow she has her good points, away north in the place you ought to regard as home. A gallant affair isn't much good when you've got a bit of grit in your eye, or something at the back of your mind. What's to be done? The husband, of course, did not send his wife away. You've got your secretary and your work, she said. There's no room for me. There's a bedroom and a sitting room exclusively for you, he replied, and a garden and half a motor car, but please yourself entirely. Do what gives you most pleasure. In that case, she said, I'll just go south for the winter. Yes, do, he said. You always enjoy it. I always do, she replied. They parted with a certain relentlessness that had a touch of wistful sentiment behind it. Off she went to her gallant affairs that were like the curate's egg, palatable in parts, and he settled down to work. He said he hated working, but he never did anything else. 10 or 11 hours a day. That's what it is to be your own master. So the winter wore away, and it was spring, when the swallows homeward fly, or northward in this case. This winter, one of a series similar, had been rather hard to get through. The bit of grit in the gallant lady's eye had worked deeper in the more she blinked. Dark faces might be dark, and icy cocktails might lend a glow. She blinked her hardest to blink that bit of grit away without success. Under the spicy balls of the mimosa, she thought of that husband of hers in his library, and of that neat, competent, but common little secretary of his, forever taking down what he said. How a man can stand it, how she can stand it, common little thing as she is, I don't know, the wife cried to herself. She meant this dictating business, this 10 hours a day intercourse, adieu, with nothing but a pencil between them and a flow of words. What was to be done? Matters, instead of improving, had grown worse. The little secretary had brought her mother and sister into the establishment. The mother was a sort of cook-housekeeper, the sister was a sort of upper maid. She did the fine laundry and looked after his clothes, and valeted him beautifully. It was really an excellent arrangement. The old mother was a splendid plain cook. The sister was all that could be desired as a valet de chambre, a fine laundress, an upper parlor maid, and a table waiter, and all economical to a degree. They knew his affairs by heart. His secretary flew to town when a creditor became dangerous, and she always smoothed over the financial crisis. He, of course, had debts, and he was working to pay them off. And if he had been a fairy prince who could call the aunts to help him, he would not have been more wonderful than in securing this secretary and her family. They took hardly any wages, and they seemed to perform the miracle of loaves and fishes daily. She, of course, was a wife who loved her husband but helped him into debt, and she still was an expensive item. Yet when she appeared at her home, the secretarial family received her with most elaborate attentions and deference. The knight returning from the Crusades didn't create a greater stir. She felt like Queen Elizabeth at Kenilworth, a sovereign paying a visit to her faithful subjects. But perhaps there lurked always this hare in her soup. Won't they be glad to be rid of me again? But they protested. No, no! They had been waiting and hoping and praying she would come. They had been pining for her to be there, in charge, the mistress, his wife. Ah, his wife! His wife! His halo was like a bucket over her head. The cook mother was of the people, so it was the upper maid daughter who came for orders. What will you order for tomorrow's lunch and dinner, Mrs. G? Well, what do you usually have? Oh, we want you to say. No, what do you usually have? We don't have anything fixed. Mother goes out and chooses the best she can find that is nice and fresh, but she thought you would tell her now what to get. Oh, I don't know. I'm not very good at that sort of thing. Ask her to go on just the same. I'm quite sure she knows best. Perhaps you'd like to suggest a sweet? No, I don't care for sweets, and you know Mr. G doesn't, so don't make one for me. Could anything be more impossible? They had the house spotless and running like a dream. How could an incompetent and extravagant wife dare to interfere when she saw their amazing and almost inspired economy? But they ran the place on simply nothing. Simply marvelous people, and the way they strewed palm branches under her feet. But that only made her feel ridiculous. Don't you think the family manage very well? He asked her tentatively. Awfully well, almost romantically well, she replied. But I suppose you're perfectly happy? I'm perfectly comfortable, he replied. I can see you are, she replied. Amazingly so. I never knew such comfort. Are you sure it isn't bad for you? She eyed him stealthily. He looked very well and extremely handsome in his histrionic way. He was shockingly well dressed and valeted, and he had that air of easy aplomb and good humor which is so becoming to a man, and which he only acquires when he is cock of his own little walk, made much of by his own hens. No, he said, taking his pipe from his mouth and smiling whimsically round at her, Do I look as if it were bad for me? No, you don't, she replied promptly, thinking naturally, as a woman is supposed to think nowadays, of his health and comfort, the foundation, apparently, of all happiness. Then, of course, away she went to the backwash. Perhaps for your work, though, it's not so good as it is for you, she said in a rather small voice. She knew he couldn't bear it if she mocked at his work for one moment. And he knew that rather small voice of hers. In what way? He said, bristles rising. Oh, I don't know, she answered indifferently. Perhaps it's not good for a man's work if he's too comfortable. I don't know about that, he said, taking a dramatic turn round the library and drawing at his pipe. Considering I work actually by the clock for 12 hours a day and for 10 hours when it's a short day, I don't think you can say I'm deteriorating from easy comfort. No, I suppose not, she admitted. Yet she did think it, nevertheless. His comfortableness didn't consist so much in good food and a soft bed as in having nobody, absolutely nobody, and nothing to contradict him. I do like to think he's got nothing to aggravate him, the secretary had said to the wife. Nothing to aggravate him? What a position for a man, fostered by women who would let nothing aggravate him. If anything would aggravate his wounded vanity, this would. So thought the wife. But what was to be done about it? In the silence of midnight she heard his voice in the distance dictating away like the voice of God to Samuel, alone and monotonous, and she imagined the little figure of the secretary busily scribbling shorthand. Then in the sunny hours of morning, while he was still in bed, he never rose till noon, from another distance came that sharp insect noise of the typewriter, like some immense grasshopper chirping and rattling. It was a secretary, poor thing, typing out his notes. That girl, she was only 28, really slaved herself to skin and bone. She was small and neat, but she was actually worn out. She did far more work than he did, for she had not only to take down all those words he uttered, she had to type them out, make 3 copies, while he was still resting. What on earth she gets out of it, thought the wife. I don't know. She's simply worn to the bone for a very poor salary, and he's never kissed her and never will, if I know anything about him. Whether his never kissing her, the secretary, that is, made it worse or better, the wife did not decide. He never kissed anybody. Whether she herself, the wife, that is, wanted to be kissed by him, even that she was not clear about. She rather thought she didn't. What on earth did she want, then? She was his wife. What on earth did she want of him? She certainly didn't want to take him down in shorthand and type out again all those words. And she didn't really want him to kiss her. She knew him too well. Yes, she knew him too well. If you know a man too well, you don't want him to kiss you. What then? What did she want? Why had she such an extraordinary hangover about him? Just because she was his wife? Why did she rather enjoy other men, and she was relentless about enjoyment, without ever taking them seriously? And why must she take him so damn seriously when she had never really enjoyed him? Of course she had had good times with him in the past, before 1,000 things, all amounting really to nothing. But she enjoyed him no more. She never even enjoyed being with him. There was a silent, ceaseless tension between them that never broke, even when they were 1,000 miles apart. Awful! That's what you call being married. What's to be done about it? Ridiculous to know it all and not to do anything about it. She came back once more, and there she was in her own home, a sort of super guest even to him, and the secretarial family devoting their lives to him. Devoting their lives to him, but actually, 3 women pouring out their lives for him day and night. But what did they get in return? Not one kiss. Very little money, because they knew all about his debts and had made it their life business to get them paid off. No expectations. 12 hours work a day. Comparative isolation, for he saw nobody. And beyond that, nothing. Perhaps a sense of uplift and importance because they saw his name and photograph in the newspapers sometimes. But would anybody believe that it was good enough? Yet they adored it. They seemed to get a deep satisfaction out of it, like people with a mission. Extraordinary. Well, if they did, let them. They were, of course, rather common, of the people. There might be a sort of glamour in it for them. But it was bad for him. No doubt about it. His work was getting diffuse and poor in quality. And what wonder? His whole tone was going down, becoming commoner. Of course it was bad for him. Being his wife, she felt she ought to do something to save him. But how could she, that perfectly devoted, marvelous secretarial family, how could she make an attack on them? Yet she loved to sweep them into oblivion. Of course they were bad for him, ruining his work, ruining his reputation as a writer, ruining his life, ruining him with their slavish service. Of course she ought to make an onslaught on them. But how could she? Such devotion! And what had she herself to offer in their place? Certainly not slavish devotion to him, nor to his flow of words. Certainly not. She imagined him stripped once more naked of secretary and secretarial family, and she shuddered. It was like throwing the naked baby in the dustbin. Couldn't do that. Yet something must be done. She felt it. She was almost tempted to get into debt for another £1,000 and send in the bill, or have it sent in to him as usual. But no, something more drastic. Something more drastic, or perhaps more gentle. She wavered between the two. And wavering, she first did nothing, came to no decision, dragged vacantly on from day to day, waiting for sufficient energy to take her departure once more. It was spring! What a fool she had been to come up in spring! And she was 40! What an idiot of a woman to go and be 40! She went down the garden in the warm afternoon when birds were whistling loudly from the cover, the sky being low and warm, and she had nothing to do. The garden was full of flowers. He loved them for the theatrical display. Lilac and snowball bushes and laburnum and red may, tulips and anemones and colored daisies. Lots of flowers, borders of forget-me-nots, bachelor's buttons. What absurd names flowers had. She would have called them blue dots and yellow blobs and white frills. Not so much sentiment, after all. There is a certain nonsense, something showy and stagey about spring, with its pushing leaves and chorus girl flowers, unless you have something corresponding inside you, which she hadn't. Oh, heaven! Beyond the hedge she heard a voice, a steady, rather theatrical voice. Oh, heaven! He was dictating to his secretary in the garden. Good God, was there nowhere to get away from it? She looked around. There was indeed plenty of escape, but what was the good of escaping? He would go on and on. She went quietly towards the hedge and listened. He was dictating a magazine article about the modern novel. What the modern novel lacks is architecture. Good God, architecture! He might just as well say, what the modern novel lacks is whalebone or a teaspoon or a tooth stopped. Yet the secretary took it down, took it down, took it down. No, this could not go on. It was more than flesh and blood could bear. She went quietly along the hedge, somewhat wolf-like in her prowl, a broad, strong woman in an expensive mustard-colored silk jersey and cream-colored pleated skirt. Her legs were long and shapely, and her shoes were expensive. With a curious wolf-like stealth, she turned the hedge and looked across at the small shaded lawn where the daisies grew impertinently. He was reclining in a colored hammock under the pink-flowering horse-chestnut tree, dressed in white serge with a fine yellow-colored linen shirt. His elegant hand dropped over the side of the hammock and beat a sort of vague rhythm to his words. At a little wicker table, the little secretary, in a green knitted frock, bent her dark head over her notebook and diligently made those awful shorthand marks. He was not difficult to take down as he dictated slowly and kept a sort of rhythm, beating time with his dangling hand. In every novel there must be one outstanding character with which we always sympathize, with whom we always sympathize, even though we recognize its, even when we are most aware of, the human frailties. Every man his own hero, thought the wife grimly, forgetting that every woman is intensely her own heroine. But what did startle her was a bluebird dashing about near the feet of the absorbed shorthand-scribbling little secretary. At least it was a blue tit, blue with gray and some yellow. But to the wife it seemed blue, that juicy spring day, in the translucent afternoon. The bluebird fluttering around the pretty but rather common little feet of the little secretary. The bluebird of happiness. Well, I'm blessed, thought the wife. Well, I'm blessed. And as she was being blessed, appeared another bluebird, that is, another blue tit, and began to wrestle with the first blue tit. a couple of bluebirds of happiness having a fight over it. Well, I'm blessed. She was more or less out of sight of the human preoccupied pair, but he was disturbed by the fighting bluebirds whose little feathers began to float loose. Get out, he said to them mildly, waving a dark yellow handkerchief at them. Fight your little fight and settle your private affairs elsewhere, my dear little gentleman. The little secretary looked up quickly, for she had already begun to write it down. He smiled at her, his twisted, whimsical smile. No, don't take that down, he said affectionately. Did you see those two tits laying into one another? No, said the little secretary, gazing brightly round, her eyes half-blinded with work. But she saw the queer, powerful, elegant, wolf-like figure of the wife behind her, and the terror came into her eyes. I did, said the wife, stepping forward with those curious, shapely she-wolf legs of hers under the very short skirt. Aren't they extraordinarily vicious little beasts, said he. Extraordinarily, she re-echoed, stooping and picking up a little breast feather. Extraordinarily. See how the feathers fly. And she got the feather on the tip of her finger and looked at it. Then she looked at the secretary. Then she looked at him. She had a queer werewolf expression between her brows. I think, he began, these are the loveliest afternoons when there's no direct sun, but all the sounds and the colors and the scents are sort of dissolved, don't you know, in the air, and the whole thing is steeped in spring. It's like being on the inside, you know how I mean, like being inside the egg and just ready to chip the shell. Quite like that, she assented without conviction. There was a little pause. The secretary said nothing. They were waiting for the wife to depart again. I suppose, said the latter, you're awfully busy as usual. Just about the same, he said, pursing his mouth deprecatingly. Again the blank pause in which he waited for her to go away again. I know I'm interrupting you, she said. As a matter of fact, he said, I was just watching those two blue tits. Pair of little demons, said the wife, blowing away the yellow feather from her fingertip. Absolutely, he said. Well, I'd better go and let you get on with your work, she said. No hurry, he said with benevolent nonchalance. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's a great success working out of doors. What made you try it, said the wife. You know you never could do it. Miss Rexall suggested it might make a change, but I don't think it altogether helps, do you, Miss Rexall? I'm sorry, said the little secretary. Why should you be sorry, said the wife, looking down at her as a wolf might look down half benignly at the little black and tan mongrel. You only suggested it for his good, I'm sure. I thought the air might be good for him, the secretary admitted. Why do people like you never think about yourselves? The wife asked. The secretary looked her in the eye. I suppose we do, in a different way, she said. A very different way, said the wife ironically. Why don't you make him think about you? She added slowly with a sort of drawl. On a soft spring afternoon like this, you ought to have him dictating poems to you about the bluebirds of happiness fluttering around your dainty little feet. I know I would if I were his secretary. There was a dead pause. The wife stood immobile and statuesque in an attitude characteristic of her, half turning back to the little secretary, half averted. She half turned her back on everything. The secretary looked at him. As a matter of fact, he said, I was doing an article on the future of the novel. I know that, said the wife. That's what's so awful. Why not something lively in the life of the novelist? There was a prolonged silence in which he looked pained and somewhat remote, statuesque. The little secretary hung her head. The wife sauntered slowly away. Just where were we, Miss Rexall? Came the sound of his voice. The little secretary started. She was feeling profoundly indignant. Their beautiful relationship, his and hers, to be so insulted. But soon she was veering downstream on the flow of his words, too busy to have any feelings except one of elation at being so busy. Tea time came. The sister brought out the tea tray into the garden, and immediately the wife appeared. She had changed and was wearing a chicory blue dress of fine cloth. The little secretary had gathered up her papers and was departing on rather high heels. Don't go, Miss Rexall, said the wife. The little secretary stopped short, then hesitated. Mother will be expecting me, she said. Tell her you're not coming, and ask your sister to bring another cup. I want you to have tea with us. Miss Rexall looked at the man, who was reared on one elbow in the hammock and was looking enigmatical, Hamlet-ish. He glanced at her quickly, then pursed his mouth in a boyish negligence. "Yes, stay and have tea with us for once," he said. "I see strawberries, and I know you're the bird for them." She glanced at him, smiled wanly, and hurried away to tell her mother. She even stayed long enough to slip on a silk dress. "Why, how smart you are," said the wife, when the little secretary reappeared on the lawn in chicory blue silk. "Oh, don't look at my dress compared to yours," said Miss Rexall. They were of the same color, indeed. "At least you earned yours, which is more than I did mine," said the wife as she poured tea. "You like it strong?" She looked with her heavy eyes at the smallish, birdy, blue-clad, overworked young woman, and her eyes seemed to speak many inexplicable dark volumes. "Oh, as it comes, thank you," said Miss Rexall, leaning nervously forward. "It's coming pretty black if you want to ruin your digestion," said the wife. "Oh, I'll have some water in it, then. Better, I should say." "How'd the work go, all right?" asked the wife as they drank tea and the two women looked at each other's blue dresses. "Oh," he said, "as well as you can expect. It was a piece of pure flummery. But it's what they want. Awful rot, wasn't it, Miss Rexall?" Miss Rexall moved uneasily on her chair. "It interested me," she said, "though not so much as the novel." "The novel? Which novel?" said the wife. "Is there another new one?" Miss Rexall looked at him. Not for worlds would she give away any of his literary activities. "Oh, I was just sketching out an idea to Miss Rexall," he said. "Tell us about it," said the wife. "Miss Rexall, you tell us what it's about." She turned on her chair and fixed the little secretary. "I'm afraid," Miss Rexall squirmed, "I haven't got it very clearly myself yet." "Oh, go along. Tell us what you have got, then." Miss Rexall sat dumb and very vexed. She felt she was being baited. She looked at the blue pleatings of her skirt. "I'm afraid I can't," she said. "Why are you afraid you can't? You're so very competent. I'm sure you've got it all at your finger ends. I expect you write a good deal of Mr. G's books for him, really. He gives you the hint and you fill it all in. Isn't that how you do it?" She spoke ironically and as if she were teasing a child, and then she glanced down at the fine pleatings of her own blue skirt, very fine and expensive. "Of course you're not speaking seriously," said Miss Rexall, rising on her mettle. "Of course I am. I've suspected for a long time, at least for some time, that you write a good deal of Mr. G's books for him from his hints." It was said in a tone of raillery, but it was cruel. "I should be terribly flattered," said Miss Rexall, straightening herself, "if I didn't know you were only trying to make me feel a fool." "Make you feel a fool? My dear child, why, nothing could be farther from me. You're twice as clever and a million times as competent as I am." "Why, my dear child, I've the greatest admiration for you. I wouldn't do what you do, not for all the pearls in India. I couldn't, anyhow." Miss Rexall closed up and was silent. "Do you mean to say my books read as if—" he began, rearing up and speaking in a harrowed voice. "I do," said the wife, "just as if Miss Rexall had written them from your hints. I honestly thought she did, when you were too busy." "How very clever of you," he said. "Very," she cried, "especially if I was wrong." "Which you were," he said. "How very extraordinary," she cried. "Well, I am once more mistaken." There was a complete pause. It was broken by Miss Rexall, who was nervously twisting her fingers. "You want to spoil what there is between me and him, I can see that," she said bitterly. "My dear, but what is there between you and him?" asked the wife. "I was happy working with him, working for him. I was happy working for him," cried Miss Rexall, tears of indignant anger and chagrin in her eyes. "My dear child," cried the wife with stimulated excitement, "go on being happy working with him. Go on being happy while you can. If it makes you happy, why then enjoy it, of course. Do you think I'd be so cruel as to want to take it away from you, working with him? I can't do shorthand and typewriting and double entrance bookkeeping or whatever it's called. I tell you, I'm utterly incompetent. I never earn anything. I'm the parasite on the British oak, like the mistletoe. The bluebird doesn't flutter round my feet. Perhaps they're too big and trampling." She looked down at her expensive shoes. "If I did have a word of criticism to offer," she said, turning to her husband, "it would be to you, Cameron, for taking so much from her and giving her nothing." "But he gives me everything, everything," cried Miss Rexall. "He gives me everything." "What do you mean by everything?" said the wife, turning on her sternly. Miss Rexall pulled up short. There was a snap in the air and a change of currents. I mean nothing that you need begrudge me, said the little secretary rather haughtily. I've never made myself cheap. There was a blank pause. My God, said the wife, you don't call that being cheap? Why, I should say you got nothing out of him at all. You only give. And if you don't call that making yourself cheap, my God.
You see, we see things different, said the secretary.
I should say we do. Thank God, rejoined the wife. On whose behalf are you thanking God? He asked sarcastically.
Everybody's, I suppose. Yours, because you get everything for nothing, and Miss Rexall's, because she seems to like it, and mine, because I'm well out of it all.
You needn't be out of it all, cried Miss Rexall magnanimously, if you didn't put yourself out of it all.
Thank you, my dear, for your offer, said the wife, rising, but I'm afraid no man can expect two bluebirds of happiness to flutter round his feet, tearing out their little feathers, with which she walked away. After a tense and desperate interim, Miss Rexall cried, And really, need any woman be jealous of me?
Quite, he said, and that was all he did say. And that was Two Bluebirds by D. H. Lawrence, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Happy by Joyce Carol Oates. She flew home at Christmas. Her mother and her mother's new husband met her at the airport. Her mother hugged her hard and told her she looked pretty, and her mother's new husband shook hands with her and told her, yes, she sure did look pretty, and welcome home. His sideburns grew razor sharp in his plump cheeks and changed color, graying in the lower part of his face. In his handshake, her hand felt small and moist, the bones close to cracking. Her mother hugged her again. God, I'm so happy to see you. Veins in her arms ropier than the girl remembered, the arms themselves thinner, but her mother was happy. You could feel it all about her. The pancake makeup on her face was a fragrant peach shade that had been blended skillfully into her throat. On her left hand she wore her new ring, a small glittering diamond set high in spiky white gold prongs. They stopped for a drink at Easy Sal's off the expressway. The girl had a club soda with a twist of lime.
"That's fancy," her mother said. Her mother and her mother's new husband had martinis on the rocks, which were their celebration drinks. For a while they talked about what the girl was studying and what her plans were, and when that subject trailed off they talked about their own plans, getting rid of the old house. That was one of the first chores, buying something smaller, newer, or maybe just renting temporarily.
"There's a new condominium village by the river," the girl's mother said. "We'll show you when we drive past." Then she smiled at something, took a swallow of her martini, squeezed the girl's arm, and leaned her head towards her, giggling.
"Jesus," she said, "it just makes me so happy having the two people I love most in the world right here with me. Right here, right now."
A waitress in a tight-fitting black satin outfit brought two more martinis and a tiny glass bowl of beer nuts.
"Thanks, sweetheart," her mother's new husband said.
The girl had spoken with her mother no more than two or three times about her plans to be remarried, always long distance, her mother kept saying. "Yes, it's sudden in your eyes, but this kind of thing always is. You know right away, or you don't know at all."
"Wait and see," the girl said very little, murmuring, "Yes, or I don't know, or I suppose so."
Her mother said in a husky voice, "He makes me feel like living again. I feel, you know, like a woman again," and the girl was too embarrassed to reply.
"As long as you're happy," she said.
Now it was nearly 8:30, and the girl was lightheaded with hunger, but her mother and her mother's new husband were on their third round of drinks. Easy Sal's had entertainment, first a pianist who'd been playing background music, old Hoagy Carmichael favorites, then a singer, female, black, V-necked red-spangled dress, then a comedian, a young woman of about 26, small, bony, angular face, no makeup, punk hairdo, dark brown, waxed, black fake leather jumpsuit, pelvis thrust forward in mock Vogue model stance, her delivery fast, brash, deadpan in the nature of mumbled asides, thinking aloud as if the patrons just happened to overhear. "The great thing about having your abortion early in the day is, like you know, the rest of the day's, gonna be fucking uphill, right? There's these half-dozen people in a jacuzzi, a lesbians in a hot tub, hot new game called Musical Holes,
Maybe it just ain't caught on yet in New Jersey. Why, nobody's laughing, huh? The words too quick and muttered for the girl to catch, but her mother and her mother's new husband seemed to hear. In any case, they were laughing, though afterward her mother's new husband confided he did not approve of dirty language issuing from women's lips, whether they were dykes or not. They stopped for dinner at a Polynesian restaurant 10 miles up the turnpike, her mother explaining that there wasn't anything decent to eat at home. Also, it was getting late, wasn't it? Tomorrow she'd be making a big dinner. That's okay, honey, isn't it? She and her new husband quarreled about getting on the turnpike, then exiting right away, but at dinner they were in high spirits again, laughing a good deal, holding hands between courses, sipping from each other's tall, frosted, bright-colored tropical drinks. Jesus, I'm crazy about that woman, her mother's new husband told the girl when her mother was in the powder room. Your mother is a high-class lady, he said. He shifted his cane chair closer, leaned moist and warm, meaty against her, an arm across her shoulders. There's nobody in the world precious to me as that lady. I want you to know that, he said. And the girl said, yes, I know it. And her mother's new husband said in a fierce voice, close to tears, damn right, sweetheart, you know it. And that story was Happy by Joyce Carol Oates from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.